We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Arteta! What a strike! What a screamer! Azola! And a fantastic goal! Arsenal back in it!
Here's Lippard, lines it up, finds the net. Arsenal in front.
In shocking move, Arsenal petitions the Premier League to reformat as a digital media and PR company, leaving this silly football lark behind. This is the Arsenal Vision post-match podcast. My name is Elliot Smith, and you can block me on Twitter at Yankee Gunner. That's right, the football, who needs it? Who cares about it? Football, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. Arsenal have proven that really when it comes to content creation, engagement, digital media, that's the stuff people care about. PR, that's what we want to celebrate. That's what we want to engage about. And the football can be left behind. Sadly, those of us who still toil away in the trenches of football, like myself and my crew here, we have to talk about the football. So we will come on to all of the issues. Ozil resigning, Aubameyang arriving, the outgoing players. I can't think of anyone really critical that left, but I'm sure maybe there was someone. I don't know. Maybe it'll come to me. We'll also talk about the manager. There were some rumors there, but we are going to talk about the Swansea game because it was fertile ground for complaining, which is what I do best anyway. And we're going to do it with Tim. You can find him on Twitter at Stilberto. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
Hello there, indeed. Paul's on Twitter at Paws in My Pants. Hey, Paws.
Hello, Elliot. Rather than a digital media company, could we petition to join the Bundesliga?
I mean, we're kind of doing that already in some ways.
Yeah,
right?
We're halfway there. We can't be further behind the leaders.
Well, hey, to be fair, if we're there, then there's only one club that we can be staring up at. Having said that, Paul, we'd have to play them twice a year, and we know what happens when we play Bayern Munich twice a year, right? Or, you know, two times.
10-2.
Yeah. And Clive's on Twitter at ClivePAFC. Hello, Clive.
Hello.
Scott will be along momentarily. I say momentarily. That could be 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 50 minutes. My guess is this will be a bumper edition. There's quite a bit to get to. Look, so that we keep you hashtag listening, let's talk about the football first. It was a trip to Swansea, and in light of the results that have happened subsequently, really a disappointing day. Chelsea seemed to be in meltdown. United don't look great. You know, there was every opportunity here to kind of put our cat amongst their pigeons, which sounds kind of dirty when you put it that way. And we didn't do it. It was really a shocking performance, statistically, visually, any way you want to sum it up. And Paul, I'll start with you. Were you surprised that he didn't let Mkhitaryan start this game from the beginning?
Well, if for no other reason than he generally doesn't just bring him in and plow over some other player.
Let me give context just really quickly. There had been a rumor, who had said it? Bold, was it Steve Bold, had said he's flying in training. Ian Wright had said on the Arscast that Steve Bold had told him that Becky's sister's boyfriend had said that he was flying in training. In any event,
there you go. Yeah, yeah, I understand that. And I know you're all geared up for Aubameyang starting at the weekend, but, you know, so I wasn't shocked. I didn't expect him to start. I expected him to be introduced, especially for a player who's everybody would accept, including our manager and probably the player himself. His confidence is not what it is. Why heap the pressure? Or put it another way, why put our problems on him to begin with? At least we brought him in as a savior who didn't make things any worse than they already were, whereas if he'd started, he would have been fully contaminated. So it might be a saving grace.
I guess that's one way to look at it. Tim, in terms of that lineup, these players to me look like players who are now just kind of confused about what they're supposed to be doing. We've gone back three, we've gone back four, we've gone back three from a back four mid-game. Elneny dropping into the defense, out of possession, moving into the midfield in possession. We started the game really poorly, and we'll come on to the goal we scored, which was quite brilliant between Ozil and Nacho, but prior to that, we were really getting our ass handed to us. To you, is it as simple as the players looking a little confused in terms of what they're supposed to be doing at this point?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of them ahead of the ball all the time, which particularly when you've got four at the back, just made us so open to the counter attack, and it was basically everything that was bad about the back four. You know, it reminded me of that Palace game that caused the switch in the first place, where, you know, Allardyce and with an air of uncharacteristic smugness delighted everyone in telling everyone about his game plan of just hooking the ball into the channels. And all right, Swansea didn't quite do it that way, but it was very much, yeah, we'll sit. And then the second you mess up, which Arsenal frequently do on the ball at the moment, they're just technically a very untidy team, we'll go for you. We'll go for those channels. And we just didn't have the space to cover it. And I don't know if it's also just that the players are a bit used to playing in a back three, particularly the centre halves. And perhaps they just find it difficult to get their spacing back when they go back to a back four. So, yeah, I think it was a bit of that. I do think that with the signings we've made, we will probably go back to a back four on a more regular basis. And this was probably, I think, the first real step towards that. But I think maybe the manager underestimated Swansea's capacity on the counter-attack and just expected them to purely defend, which they didn't. They had a game plan coming forward as well. And, you know, that Clucas equaliser, if you look at it, is the exact carbon copy of the goal Swansea scored, that Sam Clucas scored at the Emirates. It is exactly the same. And so, you know, they obviously had identified some weaknesses, probably the same ones they identified last time, albeit with a different manager. And yeah, we just, I think there were a few players that looked quite confused, and really we were just sloppy everywhere, really.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to give it to you, Tim, because you said that these smaller clubs, if they go for us a little bit, have a chance to have some joy. And so you really share some of the blame for this. I know it's pretty popular on Twitter right now to talk about the bloggers and podcasters who are to blame for the state of the club, but I think in your case, we have to say it's fairly true. So thanks for that. I want to...
Pleasure.
Yeah, well done. Clive, I want to come on to the good real quick, and that is the goal. Mesut Ozil has re-signed. I think we all believe that's important. We can do a section on that. But while no one was at their scintillating best in this game, it was a classic example of a moment of brilliance changing a game, and really should have been a changing point for the game. Turned out not to be. The ball over the top, the run from Nacho Monreal, that is not an easy pass to make or an easy run to spot. And to be fair to Monreal, it's not an easy finish. How impressed were you with both players in that move?
Yeah, it was beautiful, wasn't it? What we saw was somebody running off the ball and somebody in wide areas running off the ball and somebody with ability to find them. And we're almost back to the formation again. I know Tim sort of spoke about it briefly, but I've got to have a go on this one. I do think we have become a back three team. And we should be a back three a lot more away from home. And when people want a back four, what they're thinking about is getting people into midfield they like and getting people up front they like. What we're not realising is the makeup of our midfield is left is they're not very good defensively. They're not defensively aware. They don't run backwards very well. So we need the extra security defenders. Our fullbacks don't push quite as high in the back four as they do in the back three. So we haven't got the width. So we look very sideways like when we play. So we pass, pass. And then until he gets to Wales, we might do something a bit special. But then, because there's no Sanchez now, he's getting targeted. And so basically, I think the back three away from home is a simple strategy. Where we get our, we cover wide areas, we cover the weaknesses in midfield, and we cover the weaknesses at centre backs. The only players that want to play wide are backs. We have no real wingers anymore, and teams are just sitting there in a tight, narrow block, waiting for us to make a mistake. And they're not even kicking it long, Tim. They're actually running straight through the middle because there's nobody there. They're carrying the balls. Big Sam booted it long and chased after it. They just ran through. Leroy Fer just literally ran through our midfield. And Xhaka and Ramsey were higher, and Elneny was too deep, and there was a big hole in the middle. And we got to simplify this and say, come on, guys, away from home, let's just cover the pitch, let's just make sure we're secure, and let's make decisions on people on who needs to play, who doesn't need to play. We watched the back three of Xhaka and Ramsey in middle and midfield. We don't love it, but it works up to a point. It's a 7 out of 10 midfield. It has its issues, but if you get Ramsey playing properly like he did at Chelsea, can work. Let's just go to that away at home, right? Because we're normally in charge. But away from home, we lost, was it 7 away games we've lost?
Yeah, it's,
I think
it's
basically
bad.
We are
hitting rock bottom there. Yeah.
Yeah, so we need to really, really quickly.
Well, the good news is we don't have any big away games coming up. Certainly not against any major rivals at a place where there might be somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000 screaming fans up against us. But we'll see. And the good thing is also not a team that puts us under pressure in and out of possession. So, yeah, should be no problem. Paul, just really quickly, from a creative standpoint, I thought we really lacked anyone to take the creative responsibility. And it's easier to target Mesut Ozil right now, I think, because there's not as many people that are stepping up and taking that responsibility. Iwobi, I thought, struggled to come to terms with the game. And Ramsey didn't seem as comfortable with his role as he has throughout the season. I think in the back three, when it was him and Xhaka was sitting and he was running, he kind of looked like he understood that role and like he was enjoying it. This was not a good game for him. Do you think one of the struggles we had was just the build-up generally and that Ramsey didn't really know how to get involved?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I intimated this, but I didn't actually watch the game.
Ah, so, okay. Well, we can come to you on the transfer stuff.
No, hang on. So
extrapolate.
My wife used to be in a book club, and she told me about a book she was reading, and I dropped her off at the book club and stuck around once and joined in the conversation and ended up in a really heated debate about the book.
I can picture that. Yeah.
That shouldn't hold me back.
Well, we can come back to you on the Ramsey thing. Let me ask you about something then that you will have seen, because I know you've at least seen the highlights of their goal. Their equalizer. You know, look, Xhaka has started to come in for criticism, and I know now with Coughlin gone and Giroud gone, it is incumbent upon me to have someone to really focus all of my negativity and criticism on. And Shaka's really stepping up, I think, to be that guy. He has the broad shoulders to carry that weight, it seems. This was a problematic goal. Look, Ozil gets the ball in a difficult position. Hector Bellerin starts bombing forward, doesn't really give him the angle to give it to him. Ozil loses the ball. And from there are other mistakes. And then he doesn't really step up to cut out the pass or press the ball carrier at that point. But Xhaka just watches Klukas. He just watches him. He watches him go past. He watches him go in on goal. And the entire time from when he sees Klukas over his shoulder to when Klukas scores the goal, Xhaka covers maybe half a yard. How troubling is that clip for you to watch in terms of Xhaka's focus, defensive awareness, positioning, everything?
To pick up on Tim's point, there's a really interesting moment where the dude Koscielny's marking kind of has his back to Koscielny, and but his arms wrapped around Koscielny because he knows what they're going to do with Klukas right there.
Yeah,
he's literally marking Koscielny the way a center back's supposed to mark a forward. He has him pinned because he knows they're going to run right up that gap. That's an absolutely planned play. I just don't think they knew they were going to hit the jackpot with it being Xhaka, who's the wide cover there. And Chaka's, you know, Xhaka checks over his shoulder and he sees two guys towards the wing that he maybe confuses himself with. And he sees the guy, he sees Klukas running past him. But in an instant, the guy's, the only area I have some sympathy for him is having screwed up. Once he sees Klukas is past him, he's gone. But his whole reaction tells you is his head's just not clued in to what his job was in that situation. He needed to shore up the defense, keep it compact, stay tied to the center back, all that kind of obvious stuff.
He looks over his shoulder twice. He looks for him. He sees him. He's there. And he just keeps drifting wider.
He doesn't know his job. He doesn't know his job right there.
I almost feel like what happens is, you know, he tucks in to fill in the fullback position that Bellerin has vacated, and it's almost like he's patting himself on the back. Like, look at me. I occupied the position I'm supposed to occupy. Now I can just stop playing. It's very, very troubling, and the problem is that this is the guy in our midfield who, I realize when Elneny's playing maybe less so, but it's supposed to nominally be a defensive influence, and he just doesn't seem to have those instincts. But, I mean, Paul, is it hyperbole to say that he's quit there, that he's not paying attention? Because to me, you know, that game was sloppy and unfocused, and that moment has nothing to do with Shaka's skill. A low-skill player can cut out that chance relatively easily just by being focused.
Yeah, I mean, look, the conditions, as I understand it, were just abysmal, which is not an excuse, but it is a bit of an explanation as to how this was such an off game, because this could have been an okay game had things gone a little differently.
Well, we had gotten ourselves in front. I mean, that's why it pisses me off so much. Okay, the conditions are bad. It's not a great place to be playing football at the moment, but you've gotten ahead, and now you just have to concentrate. That's all you have to do. You know, this isn't Manchester City.
Yeah, but with this Arsenal team this season, it doesn't really matter if we go ahead or behind. The first goal doesn't seem to be that meaningful. You know, Chelsea goes ahead, we catch them. We go ahead, we lose it. And we've seen this time and time again. First goal does not determine a win in an Arsenal game. Whether it's away or at home seems to determine the result. But I also think that what you see with Xhaka is a guy who's clearly out of sorts, and it's probably reflective of the dysfunction of the team at the moment for all sorts of reasons. And we'll come into that with the discussions of the manager and the signings and stuff. But, you know, there's more going on there than a guy who didn't know his job. And you really see that in the body language as soon as the guy's gone past him.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, Tim, how about a quick word on Xhaka, just so we can get maybe a variety of perspective here in case we're piling on the guy, unfortunately. And for you and for the away support, is he becoming a source of frustration and maybe a target for some concern?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, part of me kind of has some sympathy with him because we're getting angry at him for being something that he's clearly not.
A professional football player?
Because he's a decent player with lots of really kind of valuable qualities. But he's just so far from what Arsenal need in that position. You know, we've got loads of players who like to get on the ball, who like to receive it and get the ball forward either by carrying it or by passing it. Or, you know, Xhaka likes to pass it long. We've got lots of players who just like to get on the ball. And what that means is that what Arsenal really, really, really need at the base of their midfield is someone who's switched off the ball, whose focus is getting it back. And whether that's the, and those sorts of players tend to fall into two types, and we've seen them both down the years. You've got the kind of Arteta, Gilberto, knows where to stand, knows how to block people, you know, is alive to danger. Or you've got the kind of Coquelin, Flamini, just run around like a madman and fly into tackles, and you know, and there's merits to both of them, and Arsenal need one or the other, and Jack is just neither. Off the ball, he's unbelievably switched off, probably even more than some of our attacking players, but that's clearly not who he is. You know, it's not like, and that's why I don't think you can coach him to get slightly better. But you're not going to turn him into a different player and a different person overnight. That's not that's definitely not how Arsene Wenger coaches either. You know, Wenger is, and there's a lot of logic in this, Wenger's much more focused on accentuate your strengths because, you know, to use a fairly crude mathematical analogy, if you're 8 out of 10 somewhere, it makes sense to try and get yourself up to 10 out of 10 and maximise that rather than going from like 4 out of 10 to 5 out of 10.
Yeah, that's a good point.
On something else, which, you know, ultimately doesn't really gain you that much. And so I just think Xhaka is the wrong player in the wrong team, and that doesn't necessarily mean he's a bad player, but he's, you know, he's just kryptonite, I think, for Arsenal at the moment. And I really think Arsenal have got to try something else.
It's time for him to sit down, right? I mean, is it time for Maitland-Niles or just not him?
I mean, I'd be tempted with Maitland-Niles, but at the same time, just because, you know, why not? And I'm still not 100% convinced by Elneny, albeit I kind of think Elneny better than Xhaka, and perhaps, you know, coach him to play just 5 or 10 yards further up the pitch and try and dominate the central zone of the pitch rather than kind of firefighting on the edge of his area, just being a bit braver. But possibly Maitland-Niles. We've really only seen him play in midfield once in the first team, and I am a little bit concerned that we're putting a lot on him, you know. Seeing him as the encapsulation of everything we haven't got. Well, we just don't really know yet, and it's quite a bit of pressure to put on him.
It can't be worse, though, right? I mean, like, we're plumbing some pretty steep depths in that role.
But if he turns in what Xhaka's turning in at the moment, you know, you're looking at potentially properly destroying a young player. I think it's worth a try, but I'm really wary about hanging my hat on it. If I were the manager, I'd probably looking at what I've got, which is basically we don't have enough in that position. But if I was looking at what I've got, I'd probably go with Elneny, who I don't think is perfect because I still think he's dribbled past slightly too easily sometimes. But I'd probably say, look, you play, but don't necessarily do this centre-back, defensive midfielder hybrid thing. Just play a little bit further up and cover the spaces, you know, in the middle of the pitch rather than just on the edge of your area. But yeah, I just think Jack is a bad fit.
Yeah, I think we're reaching a point now with the formations, and we talked about being confused, but the relationship between Iwobi, Xhaka, Ramsey, Elneny in this game was very confusing to me. I don't think they understood how they were supposed to be working together, and it looked like kind of four strangers on a pitch together at times.
Hey, Elliot.
Yes.
Can I ask him a question?
I mean,
in that area.
It's out of form. I mean, it's out of order, but sure, go for it.
I know. There's probably no mileage to this, and I'm grasping at very wet straws, but were the conditions, given that we're already kind of teetering on confusion and disruption and a certain amount of chaos as our, you know, this would be the third time we were playing some version of this Elneny thing backing into the center backs, or, you know, and even that, if you look at the Chelsea game, look at the variance we played in that one particular game. Was there a sense, and I think it comes,
you're taking a page out of my book of how to ask a question here, Paul.
Yeah, you see with the natural clearance that led to a goal, you see it with maybe checks uncertainty as the bog comes the ball comes into this boggy marshland. Did it also just make our midfielders and our defense not know where their spacing was as kind of things turned against them?
If I hadn't seen it in pretty much every other away game this season.
You didn't think this even a bit more?
Not really, no.
Okay.
I think you make a good point on, you know, Nacho kind of misjudging his clearance for the third goal and, you know, the second. Basically, it was a pretty poor performance, like we've seen in many of the games we've drawn away from home this season, but it just had kind of those two mistakes in it just to add to the flavour, although I think Swansea created more than we did. It's possible, but it wouldn't be high up on my explanation chart.
Yeah, look, I mean,
that, that exists.
Bummer.
I think if you wanted to apply it as an excuse, you could apply it most obviously to the check clearance, right? I mean, that's where you say maybe the conditions had him a little worried about that kick, and as a reason he missed his kick. But I think with the rest of it, it's just taking an opportunity to apply a condition and having it become an excuse. Clive, one player who did not excel in this game, and I say this as someone who really likes him and thinks he has been good, if not as productive as we like, is Lacazette. This, for me, was the first game, at least the first one that comes to mind, where I thought he was actually bad. I think he's been starved of service at times this season and still found ways to get involved, still found ways to do things productive. But in this game, I thought he was poor. Do you agree that he was poor, and what do you think the problem was?
Yep. Well, you're not going to like my answer, right? So I'm going to... A lot of it's down to the psychology of players, right? And I was having a little chat with Tim offline about this, and about people who have that dominant gene, people who are dominant in what they do. And I've always had a look at Lacazette, and I've always felt, I'm not sure how dominant you are. And people were telling me, yep, we're going to get this player. He's really strong. He's really quick. And I listened, and I looked at my previous time I'd seen him play live. I thought, I'm not sure he is a dominant player. I'm not sure he's the person that we need to lead Arsenal through every 3 days. But let's see. And he started off quite brightly. He looked quite confident. And then he played Manchester United game. And since that game, it's like the air's come out of the balloon. And you look at him now, and I know it's about football, but just look at him and what your eyes tell you. He looks physically challenged. He looks mentally crushed. He doesn't look like he can lead us, right? And this is a problem. I don't think he is a Premier League every 3 day lone centre forward. To me, he is a forward thinking, combining player that needs crowd scenes to make him feel good. I don't think he wants to lead. I mean, I coach a team, but I don't want to manage that team. I don't want to do it. I want to coach. I want to do quiet one-to-one coaching. I don't want to manage a team. I don't want to lead the group. We've all got different personalities, and it's fine. As long as you know what you are, you surround yourself with people that are appropriate. It's up to the manager to work out what he is, and it seems as though he has, potentially, by the new signing, etc. And everyone's excited because we all know he can lead us. We all know it, right? We're hopeful anyway. With Lacazette, we thought, well, he was the player that we wanted. He's the best one available on the market. He's probably 20 million too much. But you know what? We need a striker. We can't keep running around with Giroud and Welbeck, and Walker doesn't want to play there. So we're all hopeful. But I was always a little bit conservative about my love for him, even though Manchester United was a very, very good performance. So what we have now is a player that really needs time to adapt. He needs that time, and I'm not sure at 50 million he's going to get that time, because the expectation was going to be really, really high. So,
were you surprised at how slow he looked? I mean, I don't know why. No, I thought he'd be quick, and maybe to Paul's point, conditions played in here. But there was a ball played through. I don't remember who played it, but it was played in behind Watford. Well, that was another great game. Swansea, and he was in a foot race with the defender, and he got beat by the center back, and that was just shocking to me. I mean, has that surprised you, the lack of pace?
Not massively. He's quite quick moving. He's quite quick of his thought process. So he predicts movement in short spaces. That's why I always say he's a player that needs crowd scenes, because he needs people around him. He can read them, and he moves quicker than the defender. But if you make that run 15 meters, it's not going to happen for him, right? That's no surprise to me. And sometimes I think this is our fault as fans. And I think we have, much like Xhaka, we think, well, he's the one, he needs to be doing a certain role. Tim's right. Xhaka's never been that player. He's never been that defensive player. He plays with a guy for Switzerland called Zachariah, who does all that work for him, does all his running for him, and he just gives Xhaka the ball. Right? So, again, with Lacazette, we all thought he was going to be Ian Wright, stroke Thierry Henry. And when we look up and he's getting caught by people, we're thinking, well, that's not quite right. Why is he so quiet? Well, he hasn't got Ian Wright's tenaciousness. He hasn't got Ian Wright, I'm going to do a two-footed tackle and Schmeichel sort of fighting personality. He hasn't got that. He's a quiet, nice guy, this quite articulate, quite cute, quite clever how he plays, but he's not that leader, that dominant player to lead us, and that's what we have. So it'd be interesting to see how we integrate him now. I personally feel he needs to rest. He needs 2 weeks off to rest, and then we might get him back regenerated for the Europa League. But that's what I would do. I hope he doesn't play Saturday, and I hope we can give him the time to just settle in.
Yeah, I mean, he could just do what Xhaka does, which is take 2 weeks off while still playing the games. You know, it's not a bad strategy. Two more things on this match I think we should get to. And Paul, since you only saw highlights instead of watching the game 7 times, let's go with something you have seen. Their second goal, I believe it's... Oh, well, final word on Lacazette, Paul, since...
Yeah, I wanted to make a quick smart-ass comment. So, I mean, it's terrible that we destroyed Giroud's French career and kind of promoted Lacazette ahead of him, but we seem to have rectified that by getting him off to Chelsea and utterly destroying Lacazette. So
there you go. We did Giroud 2 solids in the space of 6 months. So quickly on the check error, it's a bad throw by Monreal, it's a bad pass by Mustafi, and then it's a bad kick by Cech. Cech's getting slaughtered, and people are sort of like, Cech out now. I think they are prepared for him to be gone. And I don't know why I'm not there yet. You would expect me to be one of the first in line. I feel that he has been okay as a shot stopper this season and actually bailed us out in a lot of situations. He hasn't been chucking him into his own net. He hasn't been Mignolet or whoever their other guy is, who's also Karius or whatever. I think he's been fine. Look, this is a mistake, but this is the kind of mistake that any football player can make and is not indicative of a decline as a player. But maybe there's a blind spot for me there. I did see a statistic that he has tied for the most errors or more errors or something like that than any other goalkeeper leading to goals in the Premier League.
So, 4 errors in 24 games, obviously.
Yeah, which, look, I mean, that's the number 4 is not a big number, right? If it was 3, he might be 20th on the list. I don't know. But my question to you is, do we need to start looking at a change in keeper? We're going to change keeper probably in the summer and go forward. But for right now, is keeper a position we need to be thinking about?
Well, I wouldn't do anything this season. And we need to be a little bit fair, which is, if you look at all, we've conceded a lot of goals. The vast majority of them have nothing to do with Peter Cech. He's made a few mistakes, but I wouldn't have thought this was a particularly buggy season for a keeper. You could pick out a few moments, but I mean, we all know that he does a lot that's good in terms of organization and commanding the box and coming for crosses. We're very good off set pieces and corners, and that's probably no accident overall. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts. I personally don't remember a lot of glaring howlers, a few goalkeeping situations where I thought he should have done better, and a few that led to a goal. But then I've seen that happen even with De Gea a couple of times this season. Well, so
maybe not De Gea, but
he's fucked up like twice, I think, while I was watching.
To be fair, he's also pretty much singularly the reason they're like 12 goals ahead of their expected goals conceded.
Yeah, but when you're looking at because I've seen the same stat quoted again of, you know, four clangers leading to a goal. It's a funny old stat. I don't know how they even come up with it. So I don't think it's meaningful, that particular stat. We've all seen the performances, and there's a variety of opinions based on that. I certainly don't think he's our issue overall defensively or even close to it. That all happens somewhere between midfield and the center backs, and you can see it on 3 of the goals all start with, you know, massive clangers ahead of them.
Yeah.
So
major mistakes that shouldn't be made that put someone either bearing down on Cech or in on him unmarked. Yeah, it's not great. I guess, look, the fact is Petr Cech's job security is guaranteed by a clause in his contract called the Ospina clause, where as long as David Ospina is the backup, there's no chance Petr Cech will lose his job.
And as long as Peter Cech doesn't try saving goals from behind the line, he should be fine.
Yeah, should be fine. And I do think, look, at the end of the day, right now, I will take a keeper who doesn't concede from situations. So, for example, when we had Almunia in goal, if you guys remember, you could just crowd the box on any corner kick or free kick or play long into our box, and it was – the Morris dancer. It was a shit show. It was easy to score from lofted balls into our box. And
he made everybody nervous.
Yes.
Even beyond the situations. And, you know, we all love Chesney and stuff, but he had that kind of unpredictability about him. Beyond his performances, you weren't, you know, that can be good or bad. And I don't want to get Tim all fired up here, but I'm just giving you a range of options, right? You had Almunia, who had his defense terrified, Chesney, who had everybody wondering, and Cech, who has an aura of solid as a rock, even if he's not always solid as a rock. And that's a big deal for a defense, for them to know what the keeper's going to do.
Yeah, he did make one good save in this game. I can't remember what the situation was. But anyway, all right, well, let's leave that for another day. Go ahead, Clark.
I was going to say the issue is structural. Right?
He's not
checking the byproduct of that. I mean, there was one free kick in the second half, center circle. They passed it through to a guy in the edgy area. And Koscielny had to make an unbelievable tackle to stop them going straight in on goal. And Koscielny just turned around and just pointed at the midfield. There was just nothing there. We can't be judging the keeper if our last line of defence is almost our first line of defence, right? And yes, he's not getting any younger. Yes, we know there's a change coming within a year, 18 months. But my goodness, structurally, we are a shambles when we're not focused, because we weren't saying that for the first game at Stamford Bridge, where we were focused and structurally we were excellent. So
yeah,
play when we like.
I don't remember how the situation developed, but I think we'll all remember, and Paul, you may have even seen on the highlights, the Elneny tackle, the last ditch from behind in the box tackle that he managed. I mean, it's a phenomenal tackle, but you should never be in that situation. And so, Tim, I want to kind of finish off with this, and that's Mustafi.
I got to say something. we never say why. We never say why that's happening. We don't call out the people that need to be called out. We don't say the people who are not doing their job correctly, not standing in the right places.
I try to frequently.
I think we need to really call people out on this, right? I think Shaka's part of it. Elneny's position is part of it. Ramsey's part of it as well. Ozil's lack of running back is part of it. They're all party of this. They are. Iwobi's ineffective defensive play when he feels like it is part of it. It's something we need to call out. There are some people who are our favourites that get away with it, and they play where they like and stand where they like. And then we watch the game, and there's just big gaps in the team. And I find it really frustrating that this is happening, and I think my internet's going bad, so I'm going to stop right now.
I assumed you were emphasizing certain words to re-emphasize the point.
I find it really frustrating. We need to call people out and say, well, look, you're playing, and suddenly you're playing high up, and you're not recognizing what needs to happen. For a while, he's three times. When are we going to recognise this and adjust to what the game's doing? We got away with it at Chelsea at the Emirates. We adjusted timely enough and came out of a game plan. We need to be far more fluid when people are running through our middle to adjust our position tactically.
Yeah.
So we can not get beaten by the bottom team in the league.
Yeah, and that's a good starting point. I mean, look, I tweeted it.
You don't have to say that, Clive.
At one point, yeah, that's just kicking the dog. I mean, look, at one point I tweeted out, Lauren Koscielny was 35 yards from their goal, and he was our deepest defender. We had 10 guys in their half within 35 yards of their goal. I don't know how that can be the plan. But Tim, I'm struggling with Mustafi, and I know I tend to get this way with certain players, so I always like to kind of hear a rational perspective instead of just my knee-jerk reaction. But I thought this was a really rough game for him. He had one situation where he dived in wildly and missed his challenge, and they were in. I think he is very much at fault in the back pass he gives Cech, but he's also very much at fault for their third goal, the way he gets beaten easily to the byline. He seems to be a player who cannot tackle standing up. He just does not have that calmness about him. I realize that we like him for his distribution and maybe his defending further up the pitch, but the closer he gets to goal, he seems to really struggle. Do you see the same challenges with Mustafi, or do you think he's just a victim of what everybody is, which is the bad system?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. So, I mean, he's a kind of front foot defender, and, you know, it's high risk, high reward stuff. So, you know, you expect, I think, the odd mistake from a defender like that. But there are just too many of them for Mustafi, and he's a really difficult defender to read because he rarely has a 6 or 7 out of 10. He's either brilliant or it's an absolute clown show. And it's not always just because, you know, he dives in a lot and sometimes that goes right and sometimes it goes wrong. I have seen performances for him where he has looked mature and assured and he's not been rushing in and diving in. So I really don't know what causes it at all, but he seems very, very flaky. And it's I don't know. I still feel like even after 18 months, a bit too early to read how much that's him and how much that's us infecting him. It seems like a bit of both, really, which is actually a really worrying combination.
Yeah. I mean, I am right in saying this was a rough outing for him, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was awful.
Yeah, and I mean, it's worrying only because obviously we're going to come on to the transfers now here in a second. We've added quality up the pitch. We haven't really addressed anything in the defensive or midfield areas, and I guess we're just going to try to win 7-5 every match. Let's do this. Let's get Scott's take on the match statistically and then a little bit of what we can expect from Aubameyang in terms of his statistics and what he's been doing at Dortmund all this time. And then we'll come back and talk about the good news floating around the club, which has nothing to do with football, unfortunately. So we'll talk to Scott, and we'll be right back. Joined by Scott. You can find him on Twitter at @O_that_crab and find his great work on crabstats.blogspot.com. You can also additionally find him on The Short Fuse, where he's doing some great writing as well. Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Yeah, well, so unfortunately, we're going to talk about the Swansea game, but fortunately, we're also going to talk about Aubameyang. So let's start with the bad, get it out of the way, and then we can celebrate a little bit. So as far as the Swansea game goes, this wasn't the unlucky loss that we sometimes suffer, was it?
No, this really wasn't. So, I mean, if you looked at Swansea against Liverpool last or over the weekend, that would have been more of an unlucky loss. This one, Swansea pretty much dominated based on almost any measure that you can look at, you know, outside of, you know, possession, which Arsenal had a lot of sterile possession. But the overall stats were all in Swansea's favor, so not good for Arsenal.
How'd the XG come out?
I have the XG at Swansea at 2.51, Arsenal 1.22.
So not great from either standpoint. You don't want to be giving up 2.51 XG, and you'd like to be creating more than one and change. So really, great job shitting the bed at both sides of the pitch, which is fantastic. Anything else jump out at you? I've been seeing statistics floating around about checks, errors, and our away form. Anything in particular you want to dive into before we talk about where this leaves us in the league?
I mean, just in general on errors, almost any time you're going to see an error, it's a bad, bad thing that happened. Because it's one of those things like when they're classified by Opta, it usually almost always leads to a goal or a big chance.
Interesting.
So a lot of times, like you know, somebody gets dispossessed, which to me is an error. Like there was a spot where Aaron Ramsey was kind of holding onto the ball in midfield, got his pocket picked, and a fast break started. That's not classified as an error, even though to me that is kind of a brain fart situation. So to me, an error, or something, and the stat error comes with a lot of problems. So when people, you know, post those kinds of things, to me, it doesn't really give you a ton of information. That's just my two cents on it.
Well, it sounds like it has other conditions baked into it, right? So in order for it to be an error,
does,
you
yeah.
have to
so
do something bad and then have other things happen subsequent to that, which is unrelated to the thing you did bad, potentially.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, it's not the most telling of stats. You know, it definitely does tell you something that, you know, a major screw-up happened. But to me, there's other major screw-ups that happen in the game that don't get counted as an error because whatever happened afterwards necessarily didn't meet the other check marks to get. I don't have the – maybe I'll have to check with Orbino on Twitter to see if he has a full definition of what they count as an error because to me, watching the game, there's other things that I think that you could definitely see go into that error stat. So I kind of stay away from looking at those too much.
Fair enough. I mean, I think we can agree that failing to kick a football that has been passed to you beyond on-rushing attackers is an error, but similarly, probably not going to show up in the statistics. I think it was an error for Granit Xhaka to decide to get his phone out and go on Twitter while Klukas was running by him. So, you know, I mean, that doesn't
funnily,
get picked
that
up
one
on stats.
Actually did get counted as an error also.
Wait.
Yeah, not tracking the runner.
Shaka's, that's an error, huh?
That was counted as an error.
Well, that is interesting, and that is an error. So maybe I like the statistic more than you do. We'll see. Well, look, what is really an error is not beating the bottom side when you're desperate to get back in the top four race, and our odds of staying in the top four race hadn't looked very good. They got to look even worse now. Where do we stand there?
Yeah, so before the match, I had Arsenal at 11.1%, and now after the match, I have Arsenal at 5.1%. So this was a pretty major loss. Arsenal were defending two expected points for this match, so dropping those points was huge. Although we weren't the worst team of the weekend, that would have going to Chelsea and their 3-0 loss at home to Bournemouth. That one, they lost almost 10% in their top four odds. I had them as, you know, a pretty good chance of actually coming in second, but after that loss, they are just holding on to a top four spot.
Yeah, and it makes us feel that much dumber because I think having won at Swansea with Aubameyang coming in and Mkhitaryan being integrated, we would have probably felt, you know, United losing as well, that maybe, just maybe, the race is on. Maybe we could pull something off at Wembley against Spurs in a couple of weekends and you're looking at top four, but now it seems like a distant memory. But that's the and one thing I want to ask you just really quickly, Scott, I noticed that your odds for us making top four, I think, are longer than what I see elsewhere, like the betting markets and places like that. Do you have any idea why you may show us as having less of a chance? Would that just be because you're a knowledgeable Arsenal fan and you know that if there's a chance for us to fuck it up, we will? Or is there something baked into your statistics?
You know, I'm really not sure because, I mean, if I go to look at my team ratings, I have Arsenal rated as the third best team. So I honestly don't know how other people have Arsenal higher in their actual projections because, to me, anytime you think that you have to, so when you're behind a team, you have to not just make up those points, you have to play better than them. But Arsenal had two teams ahead of them for a fourth place spot. So that means not only do they have to make up points on one team, but they have to do that for two teams. And there's only, you know, now 13 games left in the season, and they got to do that. And I understand.
And we don't play Chelsea or Liverpool again, and we play away at Spurs. So it's not like we have, you know, Chelsea, Liverpool, and Spurs all at home, all chances to make up points on them either.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was pretty down before that. So I don't know why other team or other projection models showed us with a better chance of top four.
And look, maybe the betting markets are a little bit manipulated in some respects to encourage betting. Who knows? And they are moved by where the money goes. So
that's true.
Yeah, I mean, it's not totally impacted by statistics the way your model is. In any event, let's get off the negative stuff because there's a new player, and he's good.
Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang.
Yeah, so in terms of his arrival, how excited are you? Putting aside things like age and squad building and whether it's the right move under those circumstances or the fact that we already had Lacazette, this is a guy who has some dominant statistics. Why don't you walk us through where he ranks in terms of strikers, chance creation, chance XG, all of the things that make him a premier striker in European football. For people who are maybe curious as to whether he really is worth the money and the hype, maybe you can put them at ease that he is worth the money and the hype.
Yeah, so you know how I like to do the radar thing. So one of the things that I've been working on recently was trying to key in on more specific attributes that I want to be able to measure. So I had a forward radar that looked at kind of, you know, the general characteristics of a forward. But then I just wanted to look specifically at a shooting skill, you know, because that's really what you want out of your center forward is someone who can, you know, convert those chances into goals. So when I actually looked at Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, I hope I'm doing my pronunciation better.
You nailed it, buddy. You nailed it. Those language courses are paying off for you.
Yeah, Duolingo, man.
Yeah.
But so when I was looking at him on the shooting radar, he basically ranks in the 90th percentile or higher for just about every stat that you look at. So shots per 90, he's at the 99th percentile. On target per 90, he's almost at the 100th percentile.
This is in Europe's top five leagues or just the Bundesliga?
This is the top five leagues.
Got it. Okay, great. Even better.
On his, you know, his conversion rate for shots on target, he's just below 90%. His average distance in shots, he's, you know, right at that 90th percentile. So that means his shots are very close to goal. You know, that classic poacher The number of big chances he is able to get per 90 is at the 99th percentile. The number of danger zone shots, 99th percentile. Goals per 90, 99th percentile. XG per 90, 98th percentile. His XG per shot, 98th percentile. And touches per box, touches in the box per 90, 99th percentile. So basically, he is off the charts good at the things that you want a striker to be good at.
Let's dive into the XG per 90. First of all, I thought he was leading the top five big leagues in terms of XG per 90. He was just ahead of Kane. Or is that just strikers? Is there something that maybe I'm missing? I'd seen a chart going around where he was the leader in that statistic.
So I don't have that one pulled up in front of me, but I have him at 0.88 per 90, and I think there might – I don't remember who's in front – was possibly in front of him, but he – there wouldn't be very many. So he's, yeah, right at that very top.
And maybe there are some that are just ahead of him that have lower volume and were eliminated by whatever the criteria were for the chart.
That's very true. So, yeah, this one I do have him looking at. So this is a minimum of 30 shots this year for all of these stats for the percentiles.
And, you know, look, I think there are some people, Scott, that worry, okay, well, great, he's a classic poacher is what you're telling me, and we don't create enough chances, so we don't provide service is the thing here, you know, for Whitelock. Is that struggling, for example? I tend to lean towards the idea that if your XG per 90 is that high, creating opportunities to score goals is a skill. Like, you look at Edinson Cavani, and Cavani takes an absolute ton of shots and has a ton of chances, and that's a skill. Now, I realize he plays in an exceptional team and in a league that might be weaker, but where do you stand on the idea of him being able to reproduce these kinds of numbers in an Arsenal team that doesn't always look like a well-oiled machine?
I think that being able to get shots off is a skill. Being in the right place at the right time is just something that certain people have a knack for doing. And I think that also, you know, getting those big chances, I think that is something that you can definitely see as a skill that a player has, an idea of seeing a play developing and knowing where to get to be in the right situation. You can see this kind of thing with like Aaron Ramsey too. He just finds a way to get those shots off, get in the right spot, where other people might just be that step slow to be able to find where that ball is going to be. There are just certain players that seem to always pop up and be able to get those shots.
Yeah, Ramsey just has a conversion issue. And I guess, look, and this is not to knock Lacazette, because I think Lacazette is a very, very skillful and talented player. But in terms of an XG per 90 standpoint, he wasn't even in the same area code, zip code, ballpark as Aubameyang, correct?
That's right, yeah. So he's at 0.5, which is still a very good number, but we're talking about someone who's a very good versus someone who's maybe one of the top three players in Europe.
Yeah.
Because that was the big thing. So if you look at the shooting radars, Alexander Lacazette's radar is really good, but Aubameyang's radar just takes all those spots where Lacazette is really good and puts him to, oh my God, is that even fair level?
Yeah, yep, that's great. Well, look, I mean, that definitely is a reason to get excited. I'm assuming that we will get the chance to enjoy him coming on in the 85th minute against Everton on Saturday. Anything else you want to finish up with in terms of our new-looking squad?
To me, I think it looks good. I hope that this is a – it seems like this is a medium-term plan to kind of rebuild things for the summer. It's definitely not long-term signings that Arsenal have made. You know, a lot of these guys are 28, 29. Ozil re-signing, he's 29. Aubameyang, 28. Mkhitaryan, 29. So these are definitely medium-term signings, but I think these guys still can be good for the next 2 to 3 years before they really start falling off. And so this does give a transition, if there is some sort of a transition coming, to be able to bring in their own guys without hurting the team in the short term. So I think there is a plan that you can kind of see. It's, let's see what we can do for the next 2 to 3 years, try to re-solidify a top four team, and then look to hopefully get some younger guys in with the next manager.
Yeah, I think that's an upbeat, optimistic way to look at it, and I don't have a problem with that, given that there's always plenty of doom and gloom around. It doesn't hurt to occasionally be a little bit optimistic about things. If you want more of this optimism that is driven by underlying data, you can find it on Twitter at @O_that_crab. You can find it on the web, the internet, that thing is still around, at crabstats.blogspot.com, or at The Short Fuse, where he writes a column. You'll also see some really cool videos that he posts on Twitter of the highest and lowest XG chances in the league every week, and it's really nice to look at because it gives you a better idea visually of how these models account for these chances, and you can see if you agree, disagree, understand where the flaws in the model are, where the strengths of the model are, and so on and so forth. So any event, Scott, thanks as always for coming on, and hopefully we can talk to you after the big win over Everton with Aubameyang notching his first hat trick for us.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Sounds good to me, too. All right, we'll talk to you then.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so just about what you expected. Not a good game against Swansea. Good player coming in, Aubameyang. A lot more than that happening. And I think we should start with the big news, actually, that's not a transfer, but a signing. Paul, we have re-signed Mesut Ozil. The reported wages, I think, are £350,000 a week, which means we are willing to really go the extra mile to pay a player what they would expect to make at the biggest clubs, and that's, I think, only a good sign. I mean, I know we tend to get on our soapbox about, oh, football's gone, the money in football's ridiculous, but then out of the other side of our mouth, want us to be paying what the top clubs pay in going wage, and I think that's what going rate is for someone of Mesut Ozil's quality. So how important is this signing for you, or re-signing, I should say?
It's fucking huge. I'd be interested as we go around to get everybody's vote on it, but I think it's actually the biggest deal of this window in terms of importance to the club, and especially when, yes, the player, the vote of confidence, but the significance of it going forward. I mean, this is, if he keeps doing what he's done this season, this is his team. And I'm guessing that's the pitch they made to him. I can't believe that this was just because he loves playing for Arsenal. In fact, I think that would continue to be the issue going forward. And somehow they've persuaded Ozil that the future is bright and rosy, and you could have many posticulations, whatever they are, on on how you would persuade Ozil that the future will be different to the past. And it can't be 18 months from now, can it? He's only here for 3.5 years, so there's a lot of pennies that drop with this. But just talking about Ozil, I mean, it's just, to me, it's huge.
Yeah.
Last year, if you told me he was re-signing based on some of the performances and the responses. But
yeah. Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, it is an absolutely massive, massive signing for...
First 2 years were damn good. Mm-hmm. Same with Sanchez's first 2 years. And, you know, Ozil has heard the pitch from Wenger that we would build around him and bring in world-class talent. And we brought in Sanchez the year after that, and then it stopped. So I don't think Wenger could make the pitch to Ozil that, hey, we're going to build around you and we're going to bring in world-class talent, because he's heard that before. I think it has to be far, far more than hearing
well, let
it
me
from
ask
Arsene.
Do you buy at all the rumors that have popped up that Arsene may be going and that Joachim Love? How do you say that?
Love.
Okay, Joachim Love would replace
him.
I mean,
me.
Do you give that any credence? And if so, do you think that may have been a part of this decision?
Well, I don't know about Love. Obviously, well, I do actually.
that's the saddest thing you've ever said on this podcast.
No, I do.
Do you want to know what love is, Paul?
No,
I want
no,
you
good.
To show me, Tim.
No. So there was this young girl, Arabella. I was 17. She was 16. Perhaps some would call it. Oh, sorry. Where was I? So I've no idea about Joachim Löw. Now, to go from Arsene to the nose picker is quite the gulf in class, but maybe, and you know, he's not known as the world's most tactical, technical coach, so there's a big discussion to be had, but I'm not the right one to have it. But I definitely think
so. You think where there's smoke, there may be some fire there?
Yeah, now who knows what it could be? They could bring in the next Nagelsmann under Wenger and string Wenger out for another. And I use these terms. It's very disrespectful to our beloved manager, who I love as much as anybody. So imagine this is somebody else saying it, because I feel like I'm stabbing the man in the back. I'd love somehow for this to be a happy ending for everybody and for us to win and for him to go out into the sunset with glorious victories behind him. I'm not sure how that happens, but we've got to have, you know, Sven, Ivan's PowerPoints, and Raul must have had a damn good talk with Ozil to get him to re-sign. I think it's huge, and given that Ozil maybe has better access to information, well, I hope so, than we do, maybe we should all be very heartened by Ozil signing in a way that we're not quite appreciating right now.
Yeah, I think it's huge. And look, I mean, you have to come to realize how these clubs are run right now. I mean, when you think of Manchester United, you think of Paul Pogba. You think of, even today, probably some people around the world think of Zlatan Ibrahimovic. You're now going to think of Alexis, Yuck Vomit. When you think of Chelsea, it's Eden Hazard. When you think of City, I mean, where do you start? But Kun Aguero's probably right up there. Kevin De Bruyne, I mean, they've got these talents. But the fact is that...
Yeah, De Bruyne is probably the franchise player now.
Yeah,
it?
But these clubs...
And Ozil is ours.
Yeah, but and that's the point. These clubs need these star players for their commercial deals, for their hashtag brand. They need them to attract other players. And I know this sounds silly, but Mesut Ozil has double the followers on Twitter that Arsenal does. I mean, you know, this is a massive star player, and he is the player that is really what we're building our brand around. I mean, you look at Aubameyang, and no matter how good you think he is, he's got 800,000 Twitter followers. And by the way, I realize that is a sophomoric analysis. What I'm trying to point out is that from a marketing and commercial standpoint, there is a benefit to tying down a player that you can really build a brand around. Football aside, because as we've discussed, we're not really going to try to operate as a football club anymore. So, final thought there, Paul?
Yeah, just to cap it, I mean, conversely, Ozil has made the same decision about Arsenal, and he's looked at the facts, he's heard the story, and he's judged that this is where he wants to spend his future. Yeah, the money's a big deal, but he was going to leave on a free. He would have got big money somewhere else, probably United if he wanted it, and he chose this, and it isn't because he loves London, and it ain't because he loves playing for Arsenal. And I'm not saying it means Arsenal's gone this summer, but it probably does. Whatever the pitch was, Arsene Stane are going this summer. Ozil likes what's coming. So in the absence of any other good news, apart from a couple of signings, I think maybe we should consider being heartened by the Ozil signing for more than just the fact that Ozil signed.
Yeah, and I mean, it is a massive, massive move for the club. I think from a footballing standpoint, from a commercial standpoint, I don't think you can dismiss the importance of London and the role London plays. Apparently his fiance really likes it there, you know, and that will come up in another topic momentarily. But it is
I think most career guys have gotten their wives to move somewhere for 2 or 3 years, and most career guys aren't World Cup winners paid $X hundred million. You know, I think if Ozil wanted to go anywhere, his girlfriend's coming with him.
Yeah, oh, sure. But I mean, I think liking where you live can be a reason to stay.
When you're 29, I don't think so.
Look at Olivier.
And why Olivier Giroud went to Chelsea. That's been a massive factor.
Yeah, but Olivier's different because, like, he cheated on his wife. And she has him by the balls.
All right, you know, we're not going to play amateur psychologist here, because you might start talking. Well, you might start doing it to me, and then I'll get uncomfortable. Clive,
it's all I've got.
Yeah, fair enough. I think, look, Mesut Ozil staying is massive, but obviously for a man who lays on chances at a rate that nobody else in Europe does, someone has to convert them, and that someone looks now like it's going to be Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. This is tough for me because I love Aubameyang. I've had a crush on him. Everybody has their player that they wish they could see at their club, and this is that guy for me, and I'm getting him, and I'm really excited about it. Whether it's the right move long term, we can touch on that at the very end, but as far as your excitement level for this player and your sense of how he will fit in, where does that stand for you?
Yeah, right up there. I mean, he just looks like an Arsenal player, doesn't he, straight away. He's the forward. You go around the world centre forwards. when people talk about Benzema, I was always thinking Aubameyang. He just reminds me of Thierry Henry, which is probably, we talk about brand, only Thierry Henry is still the biggest Arsenal brand out there. I mean, how many people have you met that support Arsenal because of Thierry Henry?
Well, I mean, Aubameyang himself said, you know, Henry was a big factor in him coming to Arsenal because of what he did.
What shirt number did he take?
14.
Yeah, I think he's singly the most biggest brand we have. And I bet you the Cronkies would love to have him involved with the club because the club would just explode. So Aubameyang is one of those players. It's going to be interesting to see how he does from a player profile perspective. He's perfect, really. And the reason why he's good, if we're trapped, he can break. But also his movement in the box is really, really rapid. He reminds me of like Gary Lineker in the box. Gary Lineker was very fast in the box. He sprinted to the ball. And there was a moment in the Swansea game when Mkhitaryan had the ball on the left-hand corner. And normally we would recycle it out and go around the horseshoe. He whipped the ball across the face of the area. And Lacazette was on his heels. And I thought to myself, that's interesting. He's doing things quite quickly. He's doing things quite instantly. And Aubameyang's used to that. He's used to quick movements, quick passes coming through. I think he's going to flourish with Ozil and Mkhitaryan around him. One he knows, and Ozil can get to know anybody. I think the Ozil thing is, just to touch on that, I think it's massive. And not just because he's staying, because I had a little inkling he would stay. He just spent £11 million on a house. He doesn't really want to move. I think he was always going to stay. But it did get a bit hairy there for a moment. But what it's done, it's not that he's staying, but it's the wages that he's on. That wage number has taken him up into, must be the top 10 in the world. And that means, I wonder if the shape of our squad's going to change. This is being projected now. We've got the Barcelona guy coming in. And what do Barcelona do? They have a number of highly paid players, and then they supplement that with younger players. I wonder if the makeup of our squad will change once that number's come in. Because if you're bringing somebody in now, everyone knows what the top paid player's getting. And it's going to be interesting to see what we do, what the summer holds. We could see a number of maybe smart buys, a couple of free transfers, contracts running down, of good players that we can now convince to come because we've got some poster children.
Could it mean the end of Ramsey? Could it mean we cash in on Ramsey? Because if you look at Lacazette, Aubameyang, Ozil, and Mkhitaryan right there, those are four big, big contracts already. And last year, the deal for Ramsey next summer, is he a player we're going to want to give $250,000 a week to?
I'm not sure. And that is a really great question. And this is what I spoke about this a little bit last week about maturity of being ready to let our favourites go. Ramsey's a popular player amongst people that love him and an unpopular player amongst people that don't. And I personally think he's very, very marketable for a sale to get the player that we're all moaning about that's not in our midfield right now. Like, we need something quite special to hold our midfield. And if we're going to invest in Jack and Jack gets his contract, we're sitting there now with Jack has got a 4-year contract in his pocket and Ramsey's got a year and a half, is it? Or maybe a year and a
It'll
half to go?
It'll be a year this summer, yeah. So next season
there's
would
a
be
decision to be made. There's a decision to make. If we invest in Ramsey, absolutely fine. Well, I spoke about his injury record and Jack's and Ramsey's injury record makes them one player. But this is decisions you have to make at times. If there's a big number there to get somebody, just imagine if Naby Keita was on the market, for example. That's the sort of thing that we need to do to fix the problems that we have. Now, I'm not saying that he has to go, but I'm saying it wouldn't surprise me if him and Welbeck went, because contractually they're not in a great place. And if we're now investing in these backroom people, do you think they're going to let these people go into last year their contracts again? No way. It's either sign or you go, right? So that's going to be interesting. But I wonder if the makeup of the squad's going to change. Younger players that we are now sending out on loan to prepare for pre-season, underpinning a much higher wage bill around 4, 5, 6 people, superstar players that help build the brand of the club, as we alluded to earlier on.
Yeah, well, and let's remember, look, if let's say for a second we don't get Champions League football next year, let's just say we're going to be limited by Premier League FFP rules in terms of how much we can grow our wages. And I got to believe that Aaron Ramsey's going to look around. He may not think he deserves the 350 that Messett's on, but I think he's going to expect to be over 200, and there'll be clubs that may be willing to offer that to him. And it may be a question of whether we... Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, mate.
No, please.
He needs to look around at Oxlade-Chamberlain and Theo Walcott and just seeing how, I know it's only a short term, but see how rejuvenated they look just by changing their workplace. Right, it may not last for long.
To be fair, we could point to people like Alex Leb and Alex Song, you know, other guys that didn't fare so well when they left.
we could absolutely loads of them. To be fair, but it's quite interesting that sometimes you just need to change your job, and you find things within yourself that you didn't realize were there lying dormant.
That's fair.
It's great that Theo Walcott's doing what he's doing. I know it's only a small sample size. I'm not upset to see the Ox doing fairly well at Liverpool. And if Aaron Ramsey, who we've polarized over, if he decides that he wants to go, then fair play to him. Go and do something else rather than try to fit into his team and that way it doesn't always work. But if the club's going to invest in him, then fair play to him. Try and keep fit. The best ability for an athlete is availability. Can you be more available? Can you play more games? Can we rotate you so you don't break down? Because he's a very good player. Yeah. At least we know what our future holds. But these decisions we need to make at the right time and not have the situation that we had with Alexis and Ozil this season.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously the one thing that we have to all factor into this that none of us have brought up, and Tim, I realize I need to give you a good long shot here because you may have brought it up because you tend to see 360 degrees around the problem. Paul and Clive, not so much. So I'm going to have to be the one to raise the point.
720, mate. 720. Yeah,
we have a coin now, right? We have an ICO. We have a cryptocurrency. And so we don't even have to worry about money anymore. Right, because step one, get a cryptocurrency. Step two, get paid. So, like,
we need to get blockchain into our.
We have it
midfield lineup.
We you didn't see the unveiling with the number 10 shirt? We have a cryptocurrency now. So I mean,
yeah. But
all of our money problems are solved. A blockchain. I think I tweeted to someone that what's a blockchain and can we lay it across our goal? So okay, Tim. All kidding aside, although I'm not kidding. Now that we have a cryptocurrency, our money worries are behind us. Not mine personally, sadly. Let's do this real quick because I think it has to be done, and I am probably not the guy to do it. We need to eulogize Olivier Giroud. We need to give him the send-off he deserves. So I'm not going to do it for reasons that you may or may not be aware of.
Why? Tell.
I don't know, just because I thought he was really mediocre. So, Tim, I guess the first thing is, you know, maybe just give Olivier Giroud a send-off, and then maybe you and I can have a quick discourse on how to evaluate Olivier Giroud and the move we've made.
I've written about it for this week actually, and one of the things that really makes Giroud very interesting is that the less he played, the more popular he became with the fans and the more valuable he became. And what's, you know, and I know we've already had this discussion about how, you know, and he was, you know, he was loyal to Arsenal, he did behave for the most part. He provided strong competition every time, you know, Wenger took him out of the team. He, you know, he didn't sulk. He fought to get back in. And that was, conversely, that was exactly what made him a really good squad player, that he pushed that person that was ahead of him as and when there was someone ahead of him. But yeah, what's really amazing is that now he's been like almost totally marginalised. He's become much more popular with the fans. And all of a sudden, Chelsea are interested. So, you know, we've had this discussion about players being as loyal as their options. And, you know, Giroud was good to Arsenal, but, you know, Arsenal was a pretty sweet deal for Olivier Giroud as well. And, you know, it's not like the likes of Barca or even, you know, Man City or someone like that were snipping around. But what's incredible is that he's become even more commodifiable at the age of 31 when he's barely kicking a ball. Because of what he offers from the bench, because of what he offers as an impact sub, as a rotation option. And he'll probably fit Chelsea more than he will Arsenal at the moment. Arsenal have taken a little step away from him stylistically with some of the players we've brought in now. Whereas Chelsea, you know, you look at the amount of headed goals Morata scores and you could see Giroud on the end of some of them. You know, Chelsea do get crosses in. Arsenal's wing-backs focus on getting to the byline, and whereas Chelsea's, you know, Alonso, Moses, they put some crosses in. As Pilicueta is very good at that as well. So it's stylistically a fit, and I think we can all accept that the London factor has worked for Arsenal on a lot of occasions now. This time it's probably worked a bit against us because he wanted to go to Chelsea and not Borussia Dortmund, which, you know, I understand for him and his family that makes more sense. So, you know, it kind of sucks that I think he's going to strengthen Chelsea a little bit, but if you do the maths on this, Aubameyang is going to strengthen Arsenal more than Giroud is going to strengthen Chelsea. And
are you upset that he went to Chelsea? I mean, let me ask you this. Would you have not done that deal?
Not really, no. I'd have kind of, you know, maybe whipped out the odd Dortmund brochure. Although I've been to Dortmund several times and, you know, no offence, there's really nothing there. But yeah, I think it's difficult to persuade a guy who's lived in London for 5.5 years, who already knows the city. He's obviously very settled. I think I read that his wife is pregnant again. So, you know, that's obviously a consideration. So it kind of sucks. I get it from his point of view. It's not nice seeing him in a Chelsea shirt, but you know, you take all of that out of it and look at the human side. I get it. I perfectly understand. I kind of wish he'd gone to Dortmund, really, but I'm not upset with him. And as far as the club were concerned, maybe you could say if we'd have got the Aubameyang deal done a week earlier, this may never have happened. I don't really know enough about the detail to say that for sure, but it's unfortunate, but I'm not really upset at anyone for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. Look, I struggled to warm to this guy. Some of it is stylistic, right? I like pacier forwards. I don't love the big man up front model, and I know he has a lot of technical skill and quality, but he couldn't turn and face. He did have some challenges with his conversion rate for a few seasons when he started off with us. I mean, his best ever season in the league is 16 goals and 36 starts. I don't blame him for that. I think he was bought in when we left Robin van Persie to Manchester United, and he could never be that player or replace what that player did for us. We tried
and
many times. Go ahead, yeah.
That's a really important point as well. He kind of, in a way, like it's symptomatic of Arsenal in that, you know how Arsenal hit like between 70 and 78 points every year, which is kind of consistent and good, but not quite good enough.
Yeah.
And Olivier Giroud gives you about 20 goals every year consistently, which is good. But, you know, if you're talking about punching that glass ceiling, probably just not quite good enough.
Yeah, and not league goals, by the way. I mean, so, yeah. I mean, 16 in the league is his best season. He's hit it twice. Other than that, I think 12, 11. And I take your point, and I think it's an important one. He is an exceptional backup option to have because he allows you both to try a plan B, you know, try something different. And he is a very good player. He is a very good player. I think people forget the limitations he had. I guess my problem is, can a guy who is backup quality, who is a good, solid backup quality striker, be a club legend? I mean, I see a lot of people sending him off like a legend. And I guess that's where I struggle. I mean, I don't know that I think he was ever a better player than Theo Walcott was, for example. Now, I realize Theo hung around longer and you know, he scored more goals in a shorter span of time. Theo was also a wide forward who missed a lot of time through injury. Giroud is a very attractive man who is very likable as a person.
Here we go, the Elliot eulogy.
Well, I mean, it's like the Coughlin eulogy. Well, what did you say? I did sodomized him in the coffin or whatever it was.
Sodomized him in the open face coffin. Yeah, here we go again.
All right, well, anyway, look, without wanting to do that, I guess from a rational standpoint, I'm not thrilled that he went to Chelsea. I do think it strengthens him. I think if the choice was not getting Aubameyang or getting Aubameyang, it's a no-brainer choice. He is 31. I do think a lot of people have posited that because pace is not an important part of his game, he'll age better. But I actually think someone who is slow can age worse. Look at it with Per Mertesacker, right? Mertesacker was never quick, but he lost half a step, and it became unworkable for him. And I don't think that that's an impossible situation with Giroud, that getting any slower could really make him too immobile to get onto the end of crosses, get onto the end of of, you know, those near post finishes that he likes to get into.
Look at Peter Crouch.
Yeah, that's another good example.
36, still scoring goals.
Yeah, so I mean, it could go the other way. That's absolutely right. I don't know. Look, I wish it wasn't Chelsea. I think we did the business we had to do. I'm glad we did. As far as that though, Tim, as far as the business we have done, how do you overall sort of rate and summarize this window? I mean, it is quite extraordinary for us. I look at this window as us doing the business we kind of should have / wanted to do in the summer, but somehow managed not to get it done. Is this really just summer 2017 pushed into January?
I think Yeah, maybe. I think of it more as summer 2018 pushed into January, and the club recognizing that, the club recognizing they've got a massive rebuild ahead, which is probably going to take two or three busy windows to totally sort. And they probably just kind of thought, do you know what? It's a World Cup summer. It's going to be an absolute meat market. All of the elite clubs, the super clubs, simultaneously have to rebuild at the same time. So I think a lot of activity is going to go down. And basically, if you're not in that absolute top strata, I think that with the World Cup means that a lot of business is going to be done, in my opinion, between about the 28th and 31st of August. That's when it's going to go down, because the elite clubs will do their business. There'll be a World Cup, and then, you know, everyone else will shake the tree and go for it. And I think Arsenal, maybe I'm giving them too much credit, have kind of foreseen that and said, right, we've got to break the back of some of this work early, and we've got to do it at a time when perhaps we'll take people by surprise. So there'll be no one in for Aubameyang. And, you know, I said on the last pod, Mkhitaryan, I think we got the best out of a bad situation there, but it doesn't strike me as something we really, really, really wanted. It was just, you know, let's try and make the best of this.
I mean, we wanted him at one time. We do know
that. Yeah. And nevertheless as well, obviously Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang have played together with great success. So, you know, hopefully that'll help them settle in. Overall, I'm quite positive about it. I think largely we, with the exception of Sanchez, I think we probably got rid of the players we needed to get rid of and got a bit of money for them. We cleared a bit of the wage bill and stuck it all on our star player, which I'm fine with. So overall, I put it this way, it's better than I was expecting. I'd just say, as a coda to the Aubameyang and Ozil, two very quick points, one on each of them. Aubameyang, Clive, you were talking about, you know, Lacazette and in terms of having that attitude. And I was thinking straight away, you know, there have been these kind of doubts raised about Aubameyang's attitude. And I mean, the first thing I'd say as a club in Arsenal's position, you kind of have to buy a broken egg if you want to shop on the top shelf. And like I said in the last pod, it's something we've done a lot down the years. We've taken a slightly broken, either physically or mentally, a slightly broken but top shelf player. And you know, we've really benefited from that. But I don't think Arsenal minds having a bit of a bastard up front. You know, look at Ian Wright, Nicolas Anelka. Omri was a hard character to like on a football pitch at times. Sylvain Wiltord, Robin Van Persie had that nasty streak. He tried to buy Suarez. He tried to buy Vardy. I think Arsene Wenger, not only... Yeah, Adebayor. Like,
you can go to war with these men. You can go to war with these players, right? You can't go to war with Lacazette. I'm sorry. Can't do it.
Yeah.
And I think the team as well, Tim, will look upfield and think, they've got a fucking crazy man ahead of them. Yeah. Get him the ball.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Sanchez had that as well. You know, it reminds me, have you ever seen that Simpsons episode where Bart and Homer buy a horse, a racehorse, and he's a bit shy and a bit timid, and he gets intimidated, and like Homer and Bart turn him into like a bastard, and they call him Crazy D, and he gets like, you know, like a Mohican and a nose ring and stuff. It's a bit like that. So I think Wenger's fine with having a bit of a bastard up front, a bit of a handful. And on Ozil, just to, you know, I echo everything everyone else has said. I think it's huge. We've got big sponsorship deals coming up. It's huge for the team. The team stylistically has taken a bit of a leap towards Ozil with the players we've brought in. I just say, just for balance, something we've got to keep an eye on. I'm sure that we've offered him the world. And not just financially. I'm sure the pitch was, this is your team. You're going to play in the position you want to play in, you know. And it kind of probably reminds me a bit of when we got Henri to sign that last contract. And it was, you know, we are not worthy. We will give you the whole world. It's all going to be yours. And Clive was talking about holding players to account. And it was a wonderful assist for the first goal. But my God, for their equaliser. He gets absolutely shrugged off the ball. And we're all very happy with Ozil at the moment, so we're not going to call that out because we wanted him to sign a new deal, and now he signed a new deal. And look, we all know he's not Scott Parker, and we're not asking him to be. But, you know, when you... I'm really sorry to bring this up again. I kind of hate myself for saying it, but when you think of the flak Sanchez was getting this season, compared to, like, Ozil just getting dumped on the floor like that, you know... So that's just something, and I'm not saying that I think that that's going to happen. I tend to think with the way the team is now being structured, that Ozil will thrive on that, and he's coming into his peak years. But I just really hope that, you know, we're not afraid to kind of, you know, to consider him a member of the team.
You know what?
Latin...
Great point.
Make me feel like an idiot, please.
In Latin, the phrase is primus inter pares, which means first among equals, and that's fine. First among equals is absolutely fine, but it can't be allowed to become a bit more than that. That's just something that the manager's going to have to manage.
Well, and that's... Hopefully,
the thing that differentiates him with... the Henri stage is that, you know, Messi's the giver in terms of making other people shine, whereas Henri just used it to get even more sunshine on himself. I see what you mean, but if he does step up to this being his team, he's going to wanted to work in both directions. We've seen it this last 3 or 4 months. I agree. You know, we don't want to see last year's Ozil. Hopefully he really does see this. You know, he's had to share the limelight with Sanchez, and you don't really share the limelight with Sanchez. So, to your point, it's going to be fascinating to see, has he grown as a man? Will he take this on? Will this become his team? Will he care about it going in both directions?
I think when we say Ozil's team, I think we're having players that suit him. I don't think he's a dominant personality. He's a deferent player that thinks team first, teammate second, and then himself last. He is somebody that likes to make other people look better, right? So he's a team player that I quite like. And Tim's absolutely right about the first goal. That's what I meant by we don't call it out. We don't call these things out for certain players. When I say we, I mean Arsenal fans, not just you guys, right? We need to call these things out. Of course, when we see the result and we see Xhaka standing there, not spinning his head off his shoulders, then we can spot that, and he's a target, so we can highlight it. And when we see Mustafi, who literally looked like he didn't care, we can spot that. But let's remember, there's been many games when Ozil hasn't cared, and now he's getting double the wages on everyone else in the dressing room. It's going to be interesting, but I think it's a good thing because now you're lifting it for everybody else. He has to step up to it, much like Theo Walcott. I felt people turned against him when his wages went up. If Ozil doesn't play, it'd be interesting to see what the fans do, because suddenly when you're getting 350, people expect you to play well and carry the kit back to the coach. Do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, as they say in Latin, e pluribus unum, which means money. So, you know, there's that. So, look, I think one thing, Tim, to your point, though, is that you know how you keep a player from feeling above the team? Is surrounding him with at least a few other players that he feels are his peers.
Yeah.
You know, if you put Mesut Ozil on 350 and you surround him with Alex Iwobi and Reece Nelson and Maitland-Niles, you may wind up with a problem. But, I mean, if you surround him with Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan and, you know, you bring in some other big characters and he suddenly feels like he's surrounded by players who are at his level, then I think that's a very different situation. I think the danger comes when you have a superstar in your team who is just a much better player than the caliber of talent around him. I think that doesn't work, and hopefully that's not where we're headed. The worry here, I think we have to be honest about, if we need someone to rain on our parade, and I'll surely do it in the absence of anyone else, is that...
Tim did pretty good, and then Clive went on a tear on all our players. I don't think it's necessary, Elliot.
It wasn't quite enough. Let's just go a little further. We have Mesut Ozil on $350,000 a week. He is 29 years old. We have Aubameyang coming in. He is getting ready to turn 29 years old. Henrik Mkhitaryan's on big money. He is 29 years old. The makeup of the squad right now has a lot of big talent and a lot of big contracts that in two seasons or three will look like dead money, right? We're not – none of these guys are going to command fees or, you know, sizable fees at the ends of this contract. So presumably, we are going to have these guys on big money leaving for small money in the not-too-distant future. And so we've rolled the dice with a lot of our funds and a lot of our resources pledged towards the short term. And you can understand why that might be. The club may have determined that getting back into the Champions League and being back among the top sides in Europe and England is the priority, and everything must be mortgaged to do that. But, I mean, Tim, real quick, each of you, if you want to weigh in on this, is there a concern? I mean, you have to laugh a little bit. If I told you we spent 110, 115 million pounds on two players between August and January, you'd be feeling pretty good. If I told you they were both number nines, you might say, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
Do you have any concern that, as happy as we are about the re-signing of Ozil and the arrival of Aubameyang and getting something for Alexis other than just a few pounds, that the squad makeup puts us in a very much win now stance?
Yeah, it does a bit, yeah. And that's partly the situation we've put ourselves in. I don't think we can underestimate as well the fact that the Fly Emirates and Puma deals are up for renegotiation at the end of this season, both of them. And they're both going to be absolutely huge in terms of where we can go next. And
that's
kind
such
of,
an important point.
I mean, even
yep.
Yeah, even in just in terms of staying on the plateau that we're on, they are going to be huge because we're probably looking at a second successive year without Champions League football. And that's when, you know, one year you can write off as a one-off, particularly Arsenal. Arsenal had enough credit in the bank, as it were, to be able to write off one season out of the Champions League. You do two in a row and you start to get into a bit of a funk, and I don't think it's entirely sunk cost. If keeping Mesut Ozil and signing Aubameyang, you know, like I said, I think our needs are a bit short term at the moment, but if those two, you know, if those two put another, like, I don't know, 5-10 million on either of those deals, then it's money well spent because we'll kind of get it back. Also, I think that, again, not in the long term, but in the short term, slightly tempered by the fact that I think we've still actually turned a profit in the last two transfer windows. So, you know,
yeah, I think our blog thought we were up about 20 million overall.
Yeah. And we only spent net, I think, 7 million in this window. So,
and we had the Oxlade-Chamberlain money was mostly profit for us from the last one.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, we haven't quite spent as much on all of this as it might look. I'm sorry, I know I'm getting into talk about net spend fella.
Well, don't talk about spend, talk about net spend.
but yeah, so we have kind of... We've made a bit of money as well, largely by selling off, you know, by holding a bit of a kind of garage sale. But yeah, there we go. So I think that is a little bit of a concern, but at the same time, I think it's necessary.
Well, I mean, Paul, I know you and Clive each want to get a whack at that before we say goodbye. So your turn.
Yeah. Just a quick thought. I mean, Sven potentially has come in big on these, on the Aubameyang, Mkhitaryan, and probably Ozil too. I mean, it doesn't hurt if you're the key guy laying out your vision beyond Wenger, happens to be Sven Mislintat when you're talking to Ozil. But the other part of Sven's game will be using the money you have left to bring in players that address the concern you raised, which is the player and age profile. So he's probably rubbing his hands at that, and he's probably praying that we let Ramsey go. He would probably like us to let Wilshere go, not because he doesn't necessarily like them as players and rate them, but he wants that salary cap and that money to go after players that he has in his Rolodex. I don't know if people have Rolodexes anymore, but
they definitely don't. No.
In his cell phone.
Yeah, that, I believe that's those. The way it works, yes.
So, you know, it's probably, I wouldn't say a perfect combination, but it's kind of an ideal scenario for him that he gets these three big hitters signed and re-signed. And then after that, he wants to supplement that with a whole bunch of players he has ideas for. When you're the guy finding prospects throughout Europe, even BVB aren't buying them fast enough for you. And he had his problems with BVB over the last couple of years with Klopp and even with Zorc. So he's probably got like 30 guys. He's probably worse than Ted Knutson, right? He's got 30 guys he wants in his team. All he wants is a manager to say yes and a club to finance it to get them in. And they won't be the most expensive players because there's no fun in that. He's going to want the next Weigl. So I think it could be really exciting. I might be overselling it, but it could be a near ideal scenario for a club who happens to have Sven sitting there with his Rolodex.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If he's sitting there with his Rolodex, he should be fired immediately because he's so far behind the times. Clive,
Roly.
So do you want to agree with me that we've done terrible business and the club should be shuttered or no?
No, it's not terrible business. We got out of jail just.
I'm kidding, by the way. I love the business we did. Just
Yeah, I know. It's a slight concern about the age, but you know, 28 is a new 26, right? Sports science rules. We know how to look after people. I think durability is what you should be looking at. Games played, the amount of games, short space of time. That's what you should be looking at. How many games people miss? Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan, I don't think they've got a long touchwood history of injuries. And that's the sort of thing you take into account when you buy people. Some people are just more durable than others, right? Look at LeBron James, he's never injured, right? But other people always break down. And so it's just the way it is. So I'm not overly concerned. Again, as I said earlier, squad makeup's going to be interesting. I think it's going to be so, the summer, I almost can't wait. I'm wishing it away because I think post-World Cup, what's going to happen? Are we going to go young? Are we going to go big? Are we going to have a, you know, take the Carl Jenkinsons out of the squad at £45,000 a week? Because that's what he's on. That's what the real issue was the wage bill structure and those people like Kieran Gibbs, bless him, on £60,000 a week. That's a big number. When you get three or four of those, that's a big number. We've made a great effort of reducing some of those people. Debussy went today. We couldn't sell him, so we had to give him away, right? So that's another number off of our wage bill. Uh-huh. So I think we are doing some housekeeping, which is good. We've all called for change. Some of it's really quite painful. I don't like some of it because I'm used to these players, but I'm just ready to embrace it and see how we do. And it seems as though we're embracing that. So yeah. I'm really looking forward.
Look, I should have mentioned, I am really excited by the business we did. I was laying out that argument in terms of, is there a concern? And I think, of course, there's a concern. Whenever you devote a lot of resources to a certain strategy, you have to ask the question whether that strategy is the right way to go. I think Tim made an excellent point, which is that if this strategy allows us to increase our commercial deals, the increase in our commercial deals can more than fund the expansion of our wage bill that we need it to. That's how Manchester United do it. It's not how Manchester City do it exactly, but it's the way we need to be doing it. So I thought that was a very important point. And
Tim's point was great.
No, I thought you other two, I mean, Paul and Clive had great points as well. It's just that I had taken my headset off for that and just walked out of the room.
Shared a great
so
point.
I can't really opine on that. But let's do a final thing before we say goodbye, just for the hell of it and for the fun. Tim, two quick questions prognosticating for the weekend. Question one, how many goals will Theo Walcott score?
I'll go with one, a consolation.
Just the one? Okay. And then of the Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang, Lacazette trio, which of the three in what combination will start?
I think Aubameyang will be on the bench because that's what he usually does with new signings. I think Mkhitaryan will probably play on the right. Lacazette will keep place up front, and obviously Ozil will play. I tend to think maybe Iwobi will get a game on the left, although, and this is probably a conversation for another podcast, given the time we've already gone on, given that there's really nobody in that team that properly plays on the right hand side, and both Aaron Ramsey and Jack Wilshere have been effective there at different points in their Arsenal career, you know, maybe something to consider there. But no, I think it will be Ozil, Mkhitaryan behind Lacazette on Saturday.
You think it will get a start again, huh?
Yeah, I just can't see
who else.
I think
that will be a big talking point.
I just don't see who else. It's either him or Welbeck.
You don't see any possibility. Well, you've said no, but where Lacazette and Aubameyang both start.
No.
Okay. Paul,
not at the moment, no.
Paul, how many goals will Theo score?
One assist.
One assist. And which combination of Aubameyang, Mkhitaryan, and Lacazette will start?
Yeah, I think Lacazette and Mkhitaryan, not Aubameyang.
Lacazette, Mkhitaryan. Okay, how many goals will Theo score, Clive?
In a team that doesn't have the ball, he'll score again, one goal.
One goal?
Loads of space for him.
What's the starting combination?
I think Aubameyang starts. I think Lacazette's having a rest.
And Mkhitaryan?
That would be a smart thing to do. Mkhitaryan starts as well.
Yeah, we didn't reference it, by the way. Mkhitaryan has kind of become the afterthought, but I thought he looked good when he came on. Admittedly, in a game we were chasing, so I think it's a little difficult to tell, but he could prove to be a very effective player for us.
Mkhitaryan's best patches came on the right-hand side, by the way, but I think him and Ozil will rotate around, and you've really got two proper number 10s behind the centre forward. It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
So I will say hat trick for Theo with three of the most sensational blockbuster I'm not celebrating celebrations you've ever seen. I also think that Aubameyang will start along with Mkhitaryan and Lacazette. I think they'll all be out there. I think it's going to be crazy.
No, yes. No, you do not. Seriously?
I do.
Are you joking?
I'm not joking. I think Ozil, Mkhitaryan, Lacazette, Aubameyang, I think they're all going to be out there. All of them.
Fuck off.
It's going to be
amazing.
Drop
Mustafi. Play one defender.
drop Shaka. Play Ainsley Maitland-Niles in four or five positions. It's going to be mayhem. And I'm looking forward to it. And I have to say, I know this is so stupid and so FIFA and so Football Manager, but the moves, the shakeup, it's reinvigorated my interest in a season that was starting to lose me a little bit. It's reinvigorated my interest in the club and what we're doing as a club and our urgency to become something more than just also Rans. I think it is a clear statement that we are not just satisfied with where we are, which people were wondering. So there's a lot to be excited about. Losing to Swansea, I think, may have been the final nail in the top four coffin, and Aubameyang obviously is cup tied for the Europa League, but it's still going to be fun to watch. I think we have said this on the pod a lot. All of us enjoy watching the Arsenal, whether it's Tim at every game, Clive at some games, Paul and I, you know, with our pants around our ankles in front of a TV screen or computer screen, with Pornhub in the small window or whatever it is. I mean, we want to watch great football and great players, or at least in theory, yield great football, and I'm looking forward to it. So we will come back with a summary of what I assume will be a glorious victory at the Emirates on Saturday. Tim is on Twitter at Stoberto. Thanks, Tim.
My pleasure, as always.
As always. Paul's on Twitter at Paws in My Pants. Thanks, Paws.
Woohoo!
Clive's on Twitter at Clive PAFC. Clive, thank you.
Great stuff, son.
Thank you, Dad. My name's Elliot Smith. You can block me on Twitter at Yankee Gunner. We certainly invite you to do that. Please give us a 5-star review. Write nasty things about me in the comments. If you want to just abuse me for never warming to Olivier Giroud, totally understandable. Look, I'll give him this. The man can helicopter a penis like nobody else. But yeah, we'll be back after the next game, and Scott will be back as well, I presume. So until then, yeah, leave us a review, and we'll talk to you after Arsenal 10, Everton 3.